This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, the United Nations nuclear monitor, the IAEA, adopted a resolution on Iran. After months of delicate negotiations, Iran agreed to freeze all activities related to uranium enrichment. The resolution was drafted by Britain, France, and Germany, the lead negotiators with Iran, who hoped to engage Iran in a process that would allow development of nuclear power and minimize the possibility of nuclear weapons. The Bush administration remains convinced that Iran is determined to acquire nuclear weapons, and administration spokesman said after today's vote, the U.S. reserves the right to take the case to the U.N. Security Council if Iran violates the resolution. In a few minutes, Mohammed El-Baradei, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, joins us from his headquarters in Vienna. He'll take your questions about Iran, Libya, Pakistan, or any other international nuclear issues. You can also call with questions about this agreement. The number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totm@npr.org. First, though, we go to New York, where Daphna Linzer, the diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post, has been following developments in Vienna. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Neil.
What exactly are the provisions of the resolution the IAEA passed today?
Very interesting resolution, and it's very different from previous resolutions. The idea here is to congratulate or welcome Iran's decision to fully suspend its nuclear programs in line with the deal that it signed, as you said, with France, Britain, and Germany about 2 weeks ago. And what happens next is the IAEA begins to monitor Iran's suspension to make sure that they are not doing any nuclear activities involved with uranium enrichment, as you said. And as long as that suspension is monitored, France, Britain, and Germany will continue negotiations with Iran for a long-term deal.
And the long-term deal is, part of its economic regular trade, but it's also a long-term deal that could provide Iran with light water reactors, which could provide nuclear power, which are very difficult, though, to extract weapons-grade material from.
That's exactly right, and this is really the trick of the deal. For the European trio, the long-term goal here is to stop Iran from engaging in its own nuclear program to produce nuclear fuel. But for the Iranians, it's not clear that that's their goal yet. They haven't made a strategic decision to give up the nuclear fuel cycle. They're willing to talk with the Europeans about it, but it's not clear that the two sides have the same goal here.
And this is a suspension. They've not said that they're going to continue this freeze forever and ever.
That's exactly right. The Europeans want the freeze to be permanent and are hoping that at the end of these negotiations that will be the case. The Iranians, you know, often for domestic political purposes, have been very, very specific that this is voluntary, that they don't have to be doing this, and that it's temporary.
Now, the United States is unhappy with this resolution, in part because it isn't permanent, but also in part because they think it has loopholes.
Well, that's right. And as I said at the beginning, it spends a lot of time congratulating Iran for taking these steps and for emphasizing that these steps are voluntary. I think there's only one sentence in the resolution that criticizes Iran for concealing their nuclear program for 18 years. And in that exact same sentence, it also welcomes the corrective measures that Iran has made since. So, no, the administration is not happy about it. What they really wanted in the resolution was a trigger mechanism, language that would make clear that if Iran violated this suspension, they would be sent immediately to the U.N. Security Council where they could face sanctions. They didn't get that strong trigger.
And the IAEA, unlike we're all familiar with the Security Council, where there are votes cast and you need the votes of nine votes and they all have to be, the IAEA works on consensus. So the U.S. did vote for this agreement.
Exactly. They didn't. What they decided to do was not to block consensus. They decided to let the resolution be passed. As you said, exactly, there was no reason to vote. They didn't have to put up their hand. They avoided that. And instead, what they did was issue a very strong statement of concern after the resolution was adopted. And in the statement, which was read to the IAEA's Board of Governors, Ambassador Jackie Sanders made very clear that the U.S. could at any time take Iran to the Security Council on its own. And while this has always been their policy and always been their right, I think this was the first time that they had said it so publicly.
And in Iran, I understand, this agreement is also not terribly popular because the Iranian people see it as constraining their government's freedom of action.
That's exactly right. And I think some of the hemming and hawing and some of the stalling tactics that we saw over the weekend from Iran definitely indicate just how tricky it is to win support for this in Tehran. The Iranians have said over and over again and tried to emphasize that they have a legal right, like any country has, to develop nuclear fuel, to have their own nuclear energy program. And it's not easy to decide that they're going to give it up because the U.S. is suspicious.
And as we continue with this process, the last hurdle was these 20 gas centrifuges. The Iranians said at the last minute, we've agreed to stop all uranium enrichment, except we want to continue experimenting with these 20 pieces of machinery that do exactly that, enrich uranium.
Exactly. They didn't say that they would introduce uranium into the centrifuges, but what research and development with those 20 centrifuges gives Iran is more experience, more technological know-how. It increases their capabilities should they decide one day that they want to go ahead and break the suspension, if they feel the suspension's been broken anyway, and go ahead and start making bomb-grade uranium. The longer they do research and development work with those 20 centrifuges, the better off they would be.
Thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Daphna Linzer is the Washington Post's diplomatic correspondent. She joined us on the phone from New York. As a reminder, in a few minutes, Mohammed El-Baradei, the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, will be joining us from Vienna. He'll be taking your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send email, TOTN at NPR.org is the email address. But joining us now is Joe Cirincione, the Senior Associate and Director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. His latest book is Deadly Arsenals, Tracking Weapons of Mass Destruction. He's with us here in Studio 3A, and it's nice of you to be back with us on Talk of the Nation, Joe.
Pleasure.
To begin with, there are tremendous doubts about Iran's nuclear program. The United States remains convinced that Iran is determined to acquire nuclear weapons. There are a lot of reasons the United States might think that.
Well, starting off with the idea that Iran has, for 18 years, kept some of its research a secret. Then the hostility that's developed between Iran and the United States since the Iranian Revolution of 1979. And finally, there are tensions in the Middle East between Israel, U.S. ally, and Iran, all of which contribute to make the U.S. very suspicious of Iran's intentions.
Now, given that background, and Iran's, as Daphna Linzer mentioned, for 18 years did not disclose its nuclear program, as it is obliged to do under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, of which it is a signatory. It also negotiated an agreement not all that dissimilar from this agreement a few years ago and reneged on that.
A year ago, the same EU ministers from France, Great Britain, and Germany reached an agreement with Iran to freeze its nuclear program. And that freeze stayed in place for several months. Iran felt that the negotiations weren't going anywhere. From an Iranian point of view, it was the Europeans who fell down on their end of the bargain. So as Daphne was describing, some of the internal tensions inside Iran, this is a very hot political issue inside Iran. If you think an American has trouble dealing with Social Security as a politician, imagine what it's like for an Iranian to deal with this extremely sensitive issue. The Iran pulled out about 6 months ago and started activities up again, and now we're refreezing the program.
Now, given all of this, is everybody convinced that Iran has disclosed all of its nuclear activities at this point, that there's not a secret military program going off somewhere?
No, and even Mohammed El-Baradei, as he'll probably tell you in just a few minutes, does not say that we know everything. They specifically say everything we know about we've now documented, and we have some outstanding questions, but we're not in a position to say that there's no undeclared activity. They're being very careful here, and that's why when you hear new bits of information that come up, say the information that an Iraqi dissident group detailed just a couple of weeks ago, that there's a secret facility over here at Lavishan, a northeast suburb of Tehran, that has to be taken very seriously. But fortunately, we have a mechanism in place, the IAEA inspectors, who can now go there on site and check it out. This is going to be an inspection process that we think will take another 2 years before we're in a position to say nothing of a weapons nature is actually going on. Right now, there is no weapons-related work that has been discovered.
Also, all of this equipment, is it under monitoring now by the IAEA? In other words, do they have cameras looking at these things to make sure that nobody's doing anything?
Cameras and seals and inventory control. So the last bit of equipment that was subject to some discussion, these 20 sets of centrifuges, has now been placed in a room with IAEA cameras trained on them, so we can monitor them. If anyone touches them, anything, any equipment is moved, we'll know about it.
Here's an email question we got from Eric Lead. How viable, he asks, are the monitoring procedures in terms of accurately tracking nuclear weapons programs for any agreeing nation, noting with skepticism the U.S.'s previous intelligence difficulties with WMDs in Iraq, and how effective are U.N. resolutions in enforcing compliance?
Well, you know, the U.S. administration in the run-up to the Iraq war made fun of the UN inspectors, portrayed them as stumbling Inspector Clouseaus, and
for their failure to find active Iraqi nuclear weapons
right.
programs before 1991.
But as it turns out, the UN intelligence was more accurate than the U.S. intelligence. Mohamed El-Baradei did a better job in ascertaining that there was no nuclear program in Iraq than the CIA did in its continued assertions that there were. So with cooperation, and this is the key, everybody will tell you this, with cooperation, you can have a very high degree of confidence that your verification activities are succeeding. If a country is not going to cooperate with you, that is, allow inspectors access to the sites they request to go to, then, of course, your inspection regime cannot work.
And as we're speaking with Mohamed El-Baradei, I will probably ask him about a few other issues, among them Libya's cooperation. Now, this was an important breakthrough when Libya agreed to dismantle and disclose all of its nuclear weapons activities just last year. And this was a major breakthrough that led to, among other things, other international actors in a black market for nuclear weapons plans and parts.
This is probably the model agreement, and the U.S. administration points to it. I point to it. This is how you want a country to disarm: complete disclosure, complete transparency. At first, the U.S. wanted to do this alone. They didn't want to let the IAEA in. But Mohamed El-Baradei was asserting his agency's rights to do this, keeping, you know, his role here active. And finally, the U.S. did see the benefit of this. And it's important to note this works internationally. It's very difficult for a country such as Libya to appear to be giving in to a Western power, especially with given the history of colonialism. So it's extremely beneficial to have an international agency and a man of Mohamed El-Baradei's stature and nationality, he's Egyptian by birth, coming in to be the independent, to be the objective intermediary in here. And it's much less humiliating for a country to be cooperating with the IAEA than it is for them to be seen to be giving in to the U.S. So Libya's worked out very well so far.
And let me just ask about the second half of Eric Leeds' email question, though. Is the IAEA an organization that has some teeth as well? How effective is it in keeping these activities?
Well, the IAEA went through several phases, and before the first Iraq war in 1991, its inspection process only allowed it to go to facilities that a country allowed it to go to, that was declared facilities. So it could go to spot X, but if garage Y was right next to it, it couldn't go there unless it was declared. Now, since then, they can go anywhere, anytime, and those are the new teeth that have worked out to be very effective. But all that is only effective if it's backed up by the will of the board. Mohamed El-Baradei is not an independent actor. He answers to a 35-member board, of which the U.S. is one member. If that board is willing to punish a country that doesn't cooperate, that's what this whole set of meetings was about in Vienna. Were we going to take Iran and bring it to the Security Council, subject it to possible sanctions? In the end, we found a diplomatic solution to this, and now the question is, will the U.S. join in to make it work? Will this solution hold?
And very briefly, has any country, India, Pakistan, North Korea, that has developed nuclear weapons, has any country ever been disciplined by the IAEA?
North Korea was disciplined, and that almost led to a military conflict in 1994. It was the threat of bringing sanctions against that country that brought us almost to the brink of war.
Mohamed El-Baradei joins us when we come back from a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As we mentioned earlier today in Vienna, the board of the International Atomic Energy Agency approved a resolution that welcomed Iran's suspension of its nuclear activities. The director general of the IAEA is Mohammed El-Baradei, and he joins us now on the phone from Vienna. And, sir, thank you very much for speaking with us after what I'm sure has been a long day.
It has been a long day, Neil.
Is this resolution what you had hoped for or what you thought the Iranians would agree to?
No, I think it's a good resolution, Neil, because it empowers us to continue to do robust verification in Iran. It also requests Iran and that they continue and uphold a full suspension of all the sensitive aspects of their fuel cycle, that's the enrichment program they have, and call on them to show maximum transparency and active cooperation and say that they will hold them to task as we will continue to report on them. So I think it sets in train all what we need in terms of political guidance and clear directives to Iran to cooperate.
As I think you yourself have described it, Iran has a credibility deficit in terms of its nuclear program. Are you confident now that the IAEA is now aware of all of Iran's nuclear activities?
Not yet, Neil. I think we are making steady progress, as I reported to our member states. So we are now in a much better position to understand the extension and nature of Iran's nuclear program, and that has been quite extensive. It has been developing in an undeclared way over almost two decades. So we spent the last year and a half trying to reconstruct the development of that program. We are in a much better position to understand the program, but I am not yet in a position to say that I've seen every aspect of that program. We are saying that all the declared activities, declared material, is under our control, but is there still things we haven't seen? We are not there yet.
And how long do you think it will be before you can be confident?
I think it might take us probably a couple of years, Neil. It depends, again, it depends on how Iran is cooperating, how transparent is Iran. It is a long-term process, but as long as we're making progress, as long as we do not discover evidence that this is a weapon program, as long as we see a light at the end of the tunnel, I think what we're doing now, which is verification and diplomacy, is the right way to go.
There are many who suspect that Iran is determined to acquire nuclear weapons. The country sits on one of the largest deposits of oil anywhere in the world. It has neighbors, India, Pakistan, and Israel, all of whom, of course, Russia as well, have nuclear weapons. There's a lot of reasons to believe why Iran might pursue nuclear weapons. Do you believe them when they say we're just looking to generate nuclear power?
Well, I'm agnostic on this issue, Neil. I can't really act on the basis of belief. I have to act on the basis of facts. And so far, we have seen a program, extensive program, that could be used for peaceful activities. We haven't seen a clear-cut link to a weapon program, but we haven't done our job yet. The fact that they have oil and gas does not automatically mean that this is a weapon program. I mean, you have in the U.S., you have lots of oil and gas, and you still have over 100 reactors operating. In Russia, it's the same thing. So they have an argument that they might need nuclear power for electricity. They obviously also understand that the know-how is important deterrence. I mean, that's one of the issues we are facing right now. Iran is, in fact, a symptom of that countries are developing the nuclear know-how, not only to generate electricity, but to show to their neighbor that they can develop a weapon should they decide to do so. And that's a more generic problem. We need to deal with it by limiting acquisition of the nuclear know-how with regard to enriching uranium or plutonium production, because if you have the fissile material, you are not really very far away from a weapon program.
And as we saw in several cases, acquisition of that fissile material, that's the most difficult part.
Absolutely, and that's why I am now saying in everywhere I can that we need to have a better control of this so-called right of every country to develop the capability of to have fissile material. We might look into regional center, multilateral control, but to continue to have in the next 10, 20 years, 30, 40 countries developing factories to have enriched uranium or reprocessed plutonium, then we're really talking about 30 or 40 latent nuclear weapon states, and that's not the way we would like to see our security in the future. future.
Given the proliferation of the knowledge, is a case like Iran critical? Because if you can get cooperation with Iran, where, to put it mildly, there is some tension here, if you can get cooperation in this case, does it make all those other cases later on a little bit easier?
I think Iran is a good test case, frankly, how the international community is going to organize itself to say to Iran, yes, if you have need for electricity generation, we are ready to provide you that, but you do not necessarily need to have your own fuel cycle. And that's precisely what the Europeans are trying to do now. In addition to our verification, in addition to the suspension of their enrichment program as a confidence building, the Europeans in the next couple of weeks are going to initiate a broad dialogue with Iran, basically saying to Iran, we will give you reactor technology, we will give you trade cooperation, we'll discuss your security, we'll deal with all the issues of tension that has marred our relation in the last 20 years, but you do not, in return, need to develop your own fuel cycle, because that creates a lot of international concern, as we have seen in the last few years.
One more question, and then we'll get the listeners involved in the conversation. A delegate for the United States in Vienna, Jackie Sanders, said after today's meeting, the U.S. reserves the right to refer Iran to the Security Council on its own if Iran violates this agreement. Is that how you understand this?
I think again, Rich Armitage a few days ago said that it is not bad to have the good cup and the bad cup. And the Europeans right now are playing the good cup. The U.S. is probably trying to play the bad cup. And it basically saying we also, you know, keep in the Security Council as a last point of recourse if we do not seek cooperation on the basis of diplomacy and verification. So I'm not sure that the U.S. would want to go now to the Security Council, but what they are signaling that if Iran doesn't cooperate, we might go to Security Council, which is, I think, is a view shared by many other member countries, including the European Union.
All right, let's get a caller on the line. 800-989-8255, by the way, if you'd like to join us, or send us email, totn@npr.org. Our first caller is Babak, who's joining us from Boulder, Colorado.
Good morning. Great program. Thanks for a hot topic being brought to the surface. But I hate to disappoint your guests. I'm a former pilot in the Iranian Air Force. This issue is much bigger, much older than most people want to realize or admit to. Basically, Iran is a country that is overtly, among people who want to see it, seeking nuclear weapons. Now, the cover has always been nuclear reactors such as Bushehr that was helped with the Germans and the Russians, and then it was destroyed during the revolution. And then, by the way, the name of that recent site that was discovered is Lavizan, not Lavizan.
Apologize for our mispronunciation, but go ahead.
No problem. Just setting the record straight. Being in the Air Force, we had overt programs to complement the F-14s and the F-4s and all the recently acquired Russian MiGs to have hard points, which is where your weapons are attached to the vehicle, to carry bombs that we didn't have in our inventory. If you look at the category of them, it was obvious that it was a secret program that would never tell you what is going to be attached to it. Everybody basically knew that it was going to be when and if they acquired the weapons. And a good example of that the world was awakened to was silkworm that they acquired from Chinese, and they developed it and they modified it to the North Korean.
It's a non-nuclear weapon, though.
It's not a nuclear weapon. It's a vehicle. You have to have a delivery vehicle. The problem with people talking about nuclear weapon is, have you asked yourself, why is it the Iranians have to have a 970-mile radius Shahab-2? Of course, because they want to put something really fun on the top of it that reaches Tel Aviv. Now, Iranians are not as dumb as Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein started believing his own lies. Iranians are a lot more cunning. They're a lot more progressive in the true sense of the word, in approaching this in an incremental fashion and be able to fool the world, those who are willing to believe that they do not have the nuclear weapon in their back of their mind as a primary goal of all of this.
Well, let me put that in terms of a question to Mr. Albaradei, and thank you very much for the call, Babak, but are the Iranians just stalling for time until they can draw these negotiations out, until it's too late and they can present the world with a fait accompli?
Well, I think we're doing, Neil, we're doing a very robust verification there. So it is becoming more and more difficult, frankly, for Iran now to beat the system. We cannot say, as I said, that we have done or complete our work there, but we are engaging them in a very robust verification system. They have now agreed to suspend all their enrichment program, and we will continue to do full court press, if you like, verification to make sure that there is no undeclared activities in Iran. I should ask the question. I mean, the caller mentioned, you know, why are they having, you know, this and that. We cannot read intention. We have to base ourselves on facts. You know, it is not a question of belief. It's a question of facts, and that's how we are working. But in addition, you know, if they have the intention to develop nuclear weapons, we have to ask ourselves why, and if they have a sense of insecurity, we need to address that. And that's precisely, as I mentioned, Neil, that Europeans are trying to address security issues, regional security issues with Iran. So if Iran at any point have the intention to develop nuclear weapons, you need to change frame of mind. And so you need to work on verification, but you need also to address sense of insecurities. In other words, deal with the symptoms, but also deal with the long-term causes.
Let's take another call. This is Dave, who's with us from Overland Park in Kansas.
Yes, hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Good. Got a question for you. Why should we believe Iran, especially since they've reneged on several agreements we've had with them in the past? Secondly, what does the conflict resolution look like if for some reason they don't abide by this agreement? Does it automatically go to the UN, or what is the directive of the IAEA once that happens? Thank you.
And Director General Albaradei has answered the first part of Dave's question. Why don't you go to the second part?
Well, I think it's a it's not a question of belief or disbelief. It's a question of trust and verify, and that's what we are doing. If we discover that we are not able to do our job, then the natural course of recourse is the Security Council. That if I report to our member state that we reach a point when we are not able to verify Iran nuclear program, then the Board of Governors, that's our member state, will then have to refer the matter to the Security Council. Same exact way we have done with North Korea.
Let's move on to some other areas. Obviously, congratulations today on the agreement on Iran. There are any number of states which either are known to have or are very widely believed to have nuclear weapons that don't seem to come under IAEA restrictions. These would include Libya, Pakistan, India, and North Korea at this point.
Libya is under our verification, Neil, now. I mean, Libya has been cheating the system, and now we have taken corrective action. We dismantled their program. So Libya is part of the regime because they are part of the non-proliferation treaty. But the ones that are not under our jurisdiction right now are India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea. That's correct. We can only work in countries that have accepted to be part of the regime. Unfortunately, three of the countries never joined the regime. That's India, Pakistan, and Israel. North Korea was part of the regime, then they decided to opt out. And still, there's a lot of negotiation, as you know, the six-party talks trying to get North Korea back to the system. Ultimately, I would hope that everybody will become party to that regime, India, Pakistan, and Israel. But that, unfortunately, will not happen anytime soon because they are linking. I mean, these are difficult issues. India and Pakistan are linking, or India is linking its nuclear program to the Chinese program. Israel, of course, is linking it to the peace in the Middle East. But at the end of the day, we need to move toward a world that is free from nuclear weapons. And that does not only apply to these four countries, but it applies also to the five declared nuclear weapon states. The Non-Proliferation Treaty in 1970 set as a goal for everybody is to move toward nuclear disarmament. And we need to continue to keep our eye on the ball, Neil, on that ultimately we will not be able to have a world of haves, those who have nuclear weapon and those who have not. Ultimately, we need to the nuclear weapon state need to show by example that they are also ready to rid themselves from the nuclear weapons.
You're listening to Mohammed Albaradei, Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Director General, I have to ask you, in your opinion, those five declared the great powers, the United States, Britain, France, China, and Russia, are they living up to their obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty?
Well, I think they are taking some moves. I mean, we had recently the Moscow Treaty between the U.S. and Russia, but I must say there is a feeling that they are not moving fast enough on their commitment to move to a nuclear disarmament. That commitment undertook that commitment in 1970. So after 30 some years, we still have 30,000 warheads around the world, and which is 30,000 too many, frankly. And I know it is difficult to come to a zero, nuclear weapon status, because we need to think of an alternative system of security before we can reach that state. And we are not yet, we haven't developed that system of alternative collective security system, but that does not mean that we should not drastically reduce the existing warheads. So there's a lot of cynicism that the nuclear weapon states are not moving fast enough on their commitment to move to our nuclear disarmament. And that is very important, because we need to create an environment, a global environment, that nuclear weapons are not the weapon of choice, that it is not the kind of weapon people need to develop to emulate the big boys, because the big boys are themselves moving away from nuclear weapons.
And I also wanted to ask about the network of A.Q. Khan, the Pakistani nuclear scientist who, if Pakistan is to be believed, on his own proliferated nuclear weapons designs and other materials to Iran, to North Korea, and to Libya. He is, I guess, under house arrest in Pakistan now.
Right.
Is this to you credible, that Pakistan would have allowed one of its leading scientists to conduct virtually a private foreign policy on some of these most sensitive materials?
Well, I think this is an area which still needs to be further investigated, Neil. I mean, our first priority right now is to know who got that stuff. You know, is there any other clients other than Libya and North Korea? Then the second part of the question, you know, who knew what in Pakistan? That's obviously for the Pakistani government to investigate. But from the outside, I'm more concerned about who else got the stuff from Mr. A.Q. Khan Associates. And this has been, as you know, a very extensive network that engaged or involved over 30 companies in 30 some countries, in fact. So it has been the largest private sector trade in nuclear hardware.
Mr. Mohammed El-Baradei, I know you're extremely busy. It's a very long day for you, and we thank you for taking the time at the end of it to speak with us.
Thank you for having me, Neil.
Mohammed El-Baradei is the Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, and he spoke with us on the line from Vienna. Again, earlier today, the IAEA approved an agreement with Iran to suspend all uranium enrichment activities. The United States didn't vote against it, but remains very skeptical. When we come back from a short break, Eddie Williams will join us. He's been at the helm of the nation's premier African-American think tank for 32 years now. He's stepping down. He'll talk about his career and take your calls. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.